an overwhelming flood tide of evidence of malfeasance by the Bush Republicans in 2004. In fact, there's almost no evidence that Bush won.
That's Mark Crispin Miller, and this is Writer's Voice. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Are we about to be fooled again? That's what media critic Mark Crispin Miller says in his new book, Fooled Again: How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and How They'll Steal the Next One, Too. Writer's Voice spends the hour with Miller as part of our new series on current politics, Election 2006. You can visit our website at writersvoice.net to see a list of other interviews scheduled for that series, which will be running from now until the election. Mark Crispin Miller is professor of culture and communication at NYU and the author of several books, among them Boxed In, The Culture of TV, The Bush Lexicon, and Cruel and Unusual. He's also a regular commentator on Air America. Well, Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be here.
I confess your book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them, was a fascinating but painful read. Last election day, I was one of those people calling likely Democratic voters in Ohio. And Kerry was up in the exit polls.
Right.
Then a shocking defeat. How could the exit polls have been so wrong?
Well, my belief is that they were not wrong, and we're not talking about exit polls only in Ohio, of course, but in a number of states, all of them showing Kerry as the winner, only to have Bush win by the margin Kerry was supposed to win by. Because the difference between the exit polls and the official vote count is so dramatic, and because exit polls have historically been so trustworthy, that particular fact very quickly became the object of a lot of obfuscation. You know, it was a lot of defensive arguing to try to establish good reasons why the exit polls were wrong, and the people who did the exit polls themselves were kind of leading that little campaign. What I'm trying to say is that the exit poll problem is, I think, extremely revealing, but because it quickly became the object of a lot of muddying of the waters, I actually don't pay that much attention to it in Fooled Again. There is a new book by Steve Freeman, who is a statistician at the University of Pennsylvania, called Was the 2004 Election Stolen? That entire book deals with the exit polls, and Steve makes, you know, a very convincing case that the exit polls were right, as they generally have been, as they were in Ukraine, for example. And in Ukraine, because the exit polls diverged so sharply from the official vote count, the official vote count was, quite properly, thrown into question. So what I'm trying to say here is that it's not just the exit polls. That's not the only evidence that there was something wrong. There is an overwhelming flood tide of evidence of malfeasance by the Bush Republicans in 2004. In fact, there's almost no evidence that Bush won, aside from the official numbers, which aren't really very impressive.
Well, you really have a whole range of chicanery that you go over in this book, and I'd like to kind of go by it one by one. But more recently, I just wondered if you could comment. There was an article by Robert F. Kennedy that was in Rolling Stone magazine, and then Salon.com came back with Farhad Manjoo, and he said that, you know, he's one of those people who said that exit polls can be wrong, and he also kind of picked apart Kennedy's argument in a number of different ways. Have you read that article?
Oh, I read it, and I responded to it. Farhad Manjoo's article is an embarrassment. It is an absolutely groundless, completely sloppy piece of work. I invite people to check it out because the letters that Salon then received, hundreds of letters, over 400 letters, many of them quite brilliantly pointed out some of Manjoo's mistakes. I mean, it's a hatchet job is what it is. Farhad Manjoo did the same thing with Fooled Again. I mean, the only really negative reviews I've received for this book, it's interesting to note, were in Salon and Mother Jones, you know, two ostensibly progressive media outlets. Suffice it to say, his piece is worthless, patently indefensible, and you know, all these letters make clear exactly how. The point is not so much that Salon attacked Bobby Kennedy's piece and or my book. The point is that that attack has served a certain ideological function that I think it's worth noting. The Bobby Kennedy piece has been in the works for months. I'm intimately familiar with it. In fact, I'm proud to say that Fooled Again was the inspiration for that article. And so I was in touch with Bobby while he was working on it and in the fact-checking stage, etc. It is a very, very carefully researched, thoroughly vetted piece of work. It took them months longer than, you know, it need to have taken them because they were being so meticulous in sourcing everything. And it deals only with Ohio. It's an absolutely essential thing, June 15th issue, I believe it is, Rolling Stone, that people should definitely get and read. Now, Bob Herbert of the New York Times, the op-ed guy, wrote a piece a few weeks ago hailing Kennedy's article and also mentioning my work in passing. And this was the first time that the New York Times had ever addressed the issue of election fraud. I'm serious. I mean, they had run editorials on the editorial page, but the news section of the New York Times had absolutely, completely, and still completely avoids the subject. But they did run Herbert's piece. They then ran a number of letters supporting that piece. One of them I wrote. Then Bobby Kennedy's piece came out. And you would think, and I had expected, that someone of his celebrity and respectability coming out and making this startling claim that he had been skeptical but now believes the race was stolen, you'd think that this would be big news. Well, what does the New York Times do? The New York Times ran a profile of Kennedy just the other day in the Sunday Style section. It's really more about Kennedy than it is about the issue, and it treats the issue as kind of ambiguous and refers to the article in Rolling Stone as a much-challenged piece, and suggests that there is a huge amount of controversy over whether or not it adds up or not. Well, there really is not much controversy at all. Salon attacked it, and then there was an enormous counterattack that really put Manju in his place. What I'm telling you, Francesca, is that that piece by Manju served the ideological purpose of allowing the press to say that Kennedy's piece is controversial.
We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller about the 2004 election and how it was stolen. Do you think the Style section of the New York Times is an appropriate place to put an article about Robert F. Kennedy's piece?
No, that's exactly the point. The Style section, it's all about the great vacations he takes. It's all about the wacky positions that he espouses publicly. So it's really a kind of insult to the issue, or it's a slight to the issue and an insult to those who take it seriously. And we're talking about American democracy here. The Times, you know, really belittled it by treating it in that section and in that way.
Right. And so now to the question, which is in the more general media silence, or as you call it, institutional refusal and blithe contempt. Actually, do you have the book there?
Yeah.
I'd love it if you wouldn't mind reading a paragraph I picked out about that.
Okay, let me get my copy.
It's on 274.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to have you read it not only because it's pertinent to what we're just talking about, but also because I think it's a wonderful example of your language. This is a really ferociously well-written book.
Oh, thank you.
So I wonder if you could read, starting with that second paragraph, the press, and just kind of going down to Bush and Company's character.
Okay. The press was serving not the public interest, as the framers had intended, but the livid movement that had partly seized the U.S. government 4 years before and was now about to try to grab it all. Far more troubling than the journalistic silence on the problems of one addled and addicted airman. This is about Bush's military history, although directly linked to that peculiar blackout. So far more troubling than the journalistic silence on that whole controversy was the press's utter failure to report on the regime's extremist tendencies, its theocratic aims and hatred of democracy, its love of punishment and force, its proud irrationality, its endless wrathful projectivity. The members of the press looked stalwartly away from every evidence of Bush and Company's character.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in many ways that sums up some of the most important arguments of your book. And I'd like to delve into a number of the different points. But let's stick with the press for just a moment there, because it's such an example of what you talk about. Here they're kind of impugning Robert F. Kennedy's character without ever talking about Bush's character.
Yeah. It might be an overstatement to say they impugn his character, but they certainly... There was a tone of faint amusement at his lovable eccentricities. It was certainly patronizing. But you're absolutely right. This is what they do. They basically function as a kind of mouthpiece for the right, which can only deal in ad hominem attacks. The right never answers arguments. They only smear the person making the argument. This was the case with their response to the Conyers report. The Conyers report came out in January of 2005.
And that's Congressman John Conyers.
That's John Conyers, who's the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, say, whose Democratic members did a study of what happened in Ohio on Election Day. They had asked the Republicans to participate, but the Republicans refused. The Conyers report, which is available in book form under the title What Went Wrong in Ohio, is just a terrifically important piece of work. It's solid, and it documents all the stuff that went down in Ohio. So the Congress had to debate on this report when they were formally presenting the electoral votes for each state on January 6, 2005. And their debate and all their discussions of election fraud always basically do the same thing. They make fun of, they revile the people who are concerned about the issue. They call them extremists, they call them paranoids, they call them conspiracy theorists. They refer to them as the Michael Moore wing of the Democratic Party, which is ironic because Michael Moore does not think the election was stolen. But the point is, the press works in the same way. The press will, you know, go to town on someone like Scott Ritter. You may remember.
I do.
When he was so brave and so well-informed about, you know, he stepped forward to take serious issue with this government's case for war in Iraq. And, you know, he became an object of amusement. People would be trotted out to say, you know, this guy's crazy or he's a traitor or he's doing it for the money. The New York Times, Michael Kelly did a hatchet job on Scott as a cover story in the Times Magazine, all about his psychology, his demagoguery, etc. It's so perverse. It comes right out of Orwell. Because look what we have for a president and vice president. Look what kinds of, you know, excess and blindness and fanaticism and incompetence and malevolence we have at the top of the government today. And it's their critics who end up being, you know, scrutinized in this sort of dismissive way. So,
and we should say also, I mean, I saw Scott Ritter. He came here to speak, and every single one of his predictions about the war of Iraq were borne out.
Absolutely. He was absolutely right. Everything he said was right. I have a whole chapter on that, you know, the treatment of Scott Ritter in my last book, Cruel and Unusual, which people might want to look at, because it just documents the disgraceful way in which the mainstream press here treated him. I mean, it might as well have been the Soviet press. He was an official enemy of the state and pilloried for raising legitimate questions and, as you say, making points, all of which have been borne out by time. It's remarkable. Those who were trotted out to refute him didn't know what they were talking about, people like James Woolsey and so on. They had not a clue as to what they were talking about.
James Woolsey, the CIA?
The CIA guy, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were all dragged out on CNN and other forums and would make these authoritative-sounding harumphs about what Scott was saying. You know, he was right and they were wrong. And now, you know, the mountain of corpses is ever growing. This is not a game. This is serious stuff. And the press has completely failed its duty.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Mark Crispin Miller about his book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. Well, you know, I spoke with Helen Thomas, and she has a lot of criticisms of the press as well in her new book, Watchdogs of Democracy. But she told me she thought that the press was finally waking up.
What do you think,
and especially with respect to this issue of election fraud?
Well, I think that, let's put it this way, the press has finally bowed to the inevitable. Things have changed. My book came out last November. There was a press blackout on it, and actually there remains a press blackout on it that was astonishing. I couldn't get a single NPR interview, and these are shows I'd done many times in the past. The NPR affiliate in Philadelphia, WHYY, actually refused to run paid ads for the book.
Wow.
I got no mainstream reviews, Times, The Post, forget it, and I got on no network TV or radio shows except for Air America, and I was on Pacifica a couple of times. But, you know, I was on C-SPAN. I mean, I got whatever coverage I could get, but it was absolutely an impenetrable wall. Now, that has changed. So much stuff has come out, and it's not about the election in 2004, which I think remains shrouded in denial, but it is, and I think properly, about what's happening now, what has happened since, and what's likely to happen next time. There's so much scandal. Sometimes it seems every day, new scandal, over these electronic voting machines that are being forced on the American people nationwide, that now Newsweek has covered the issue, and NPR has finally covered the issue, and the PBS NewsHour has covered the issue. The coverage is, in most cases, is not adequate. They continue to do with this issue what the press did for too long with smoking or global warming. You know, they get treated as controversies. There's arguments on both sides.
Right.
Well, there's, you know, anyone who has seriously studied the election of 2004, even those who insist it wasn't stolen, for political reasons, I guess, they insist that, all agree that it was a mess, that in many ways the will of the electorate was thwarted. There's no argument over this. I mean, there are a few oddballs and sellouts and careerists and crackpots, you know, who insist that there was nothing wrong, really. It was basically okay. But that doesn't constitute any kind of a consensus. So, you know, the coverage has a long way to go. My view, Francesca, and I felt this from the beginning and I continue to feel it, a lot of people don't want to point fingers. They don't want to say somebody tried to steal the election. They will say there was fraud on both sides. Well, I got news for them. There was not fraud on both sides. There really wasn't any Democratic fraud. I'm not a Democrat. I'm from Chicago. I know full well what Democrats can do. Nobody has to lecture me on that. I've watched Mayor Daley operate my whole childhood and adolescence, so I'm not, you know, naive about that. But as a matter of fact, in 2000 and in 2002 and in 2004, there was virtually no Democratic fraud to speak of. There were all these rumors, propaganda myths of widespread voter fraud, but they turned out to be bogus, with just a very few exceptions. To compare those exceptions with what was going on among the Republicans, it's like trying to compare a pickpocket ring to the mafia. I mean, there's just no comparison. Until we face the fact that our problem is not a problem with machines per se, that our problem is not a problem of election fraud as we have always suffered from it. Our problem is not a policy problem. It's not a procedural problem. It's not a technical problem. The problem is the Republican Party has been hijacked by a profoundly anti-democratic and anti-rational movement. This is an extremist movement. It doesn't even regard itself as based on reason. It regards itself as faith-based. It is equally addicted to a kind of crackpot theology and an extreme laissez-faire, pro-corporate plutocracy. They will do anything to subvert the will of the electorate. That is the problem.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people talk about how everything the White House does is political, quote unquote.
Mm.
But you say that actually their agenda is profoundly anti-political.
Well, in the sense that, I mean, of course, they are astonishingly cynical, and they really have, I think, forgotten the crucial distinction between propaganda and reality. So in that sense, of course, they are very political. But when I say they're also anti-political, they detest the give and take of politics. Their version of politics is one that completely, eliminates opposition. It does away with the need for compromise. There is no deliberation. Bush and Cheney have a distinctly fascistic loathing for deliberation. I mean, Bush has referred to the UN and to Congress as debating societies. It's exactly the way that Mussolini referred to Parliament. You know, it's all talk. We act. We do things. That's the fascist view.
They create their own reality.
They create their own reality. Our Congress has been reduced to a rubber stamp assembly, which is what we always referred to, the General Assembly in Iraq as being, and rightly, because that's what it was. Ours is the same. The Democrats basically aren't consulted before big votes. It's as if they're not even there. You know, we've got a movement that is anti-political in the sense that it's not about pluralism. It's not about compromise. It's about the imposition on the whole country of a really regressive, dangerous, apocalyptic program. So what Fooled Again is all about, you know, it's not just about technical infractions of the law. It's not just about, oh, we must have more reliable computerized voting machines. Our entire way of life, our system of government, the ideals of the Enlightenment on which the founding of this republic was based, all of this is under concerted challenge by a movement that is profoundly hostile to the Enlightenment. Well, and I believe that, you know, until we face this fact, and until the American people are finally told what the Bush Republicans did on 2004, we're not going to have any reforms. If we keep tap dancing around and pretending it's a problem on both sides, that's not going to mobilize anyone to call for the kind of revolution that we really need. We have to revisit our revolutionary heritage and learn to cherish it in a way that we haven't done for a very long time.
Those are very powerful words, and I really want to get back to some of that more toward the end of the interview. But now, I think it would be important for our listeners to hear some of the details that you go into in the book in just exactly how this anti-political and anti-democratic project came about in the 2004 election.
Okay. First of all, I mean, to give people the appropriate big picture, they have to understand that the Christian Coalition began the project of infiltrating and taking over the Republican Party in the early 90s, which is not a coincidence because the Cold War had just ended and deprived the paranoid right of a long-standing external enemy to focus on. So I think that the whole jihad against Bill Clinton, for example, was primarily the result of the disappearance of the Soviet threat. And that's when the religious right really started to kick in and to kind of kick our heads in. And they gradually, slowly but surely, took over the Republican Party, took over school boards, took over state legislatures, functioning really after the fashion of the Bolsheviks, whom the leaders of the religious right actually admire and have openly praised. So 2004 is the...
You said they admired the Bolsheviks?
Yeah. Grover Norquist and Paul Weyrich, you know, these people, these theocratic activists, have publicly praised Lenin and Trotsky for their tactical brilliance.
Oh, this is so...
Isn't that bizarre?
It is bizarre. You call them Bolsheviks, which when I read that made me laugh because a while ago I thought of making a commentary that I wanted to send into NPR called Back in the USSR.
Great idea. Oh, yeah. No, the paranoid right, the anti-communist right, the extreme paranoid anti-communist right, like the John Birch Society, was always identifying profoundly with the communists. I mean, their anti-communism wasn't based on ideology or history. It was based on pathology. And it's interesting to note that the Dominionist movement, the Christian Reconstructionist movement, which is the hardcore theocratic movement that basically kind of dominates the religious right today, that movement started with the John Birch Society. So, you know, what we're dealing with now is a kind of metastasis of a process that was already started, you know, like in the 50s. But at any rate, that's the big picture.
Let me interrupt you because I guess the details will have to wait just a little bit because I want you to explain a little bit better what you mean about this pathology. You've talked about paranoia. In the book, you talk about the projection.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, if I may say so, I think Fooled Again is valuable for two things that it does. And one is that it just lays out, chronicles, and documents this epidemic of fraud that went on coast to coast. But it doesn't do only that. It also analyzes the mindset behind the fraud, because too many people are apt to think, well, you know, parties always steal elections, both parties have done it, and that's true. But I believe that the theft of the election in 2004 was unprecedented, not only in its scale and not only in its technological sophistication, because the use of voting machines is something new, you know, at that extent. But most importantly, the theft of the 2004 election was unprecedented in its motivation. This was not just a case of a party like Tammany Hall or the Daily Machine wanting to hang on to the spoils and the power. Those are rational motivations. I believe that the Bush-Cheney right is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a conservative movement. I can't think of a single conservative principle they haven't violated. It is a radical movement, and its motivation is primarily pathological. Certainly the corporate sector has helped enormously. They've written the legislation. They work Cheney's strings and so on. But I think it's a grave mistake to write this whole thing off as nothing but an economic phenomenon, because there's a component of pathological hostility in the movement. That is, if you removed it, there would be no movement. You know, if you took away from Rush Limbaugh and from Sean Hannity and from Bill O'Reilly and from Ann Coulter and from Tom DeLay, if you took out of those figures this relentless, livid hatred of their enemies and their constant assaults on their enemies as evil, if you took that away, there would be nothing left. And I think it's based on what psychologists call projection. I don't think it's based on any real ideological position. I think it's based on self-hatred. It's based on the tendency that paranoids have to attack others for their own dark side, you know, to impute their own fears and desires, which frighten them, onto the others. This is why there's so many bizarre closet cases on the Bush-Cheney right. You know, we hear so many stories of these, you know, legislators and moralists, these people who are screaming about family values. They find them in a men's room, you know, trying to grope some other guy. This happens all the time. The Jeffrey Gannon scandal, which should have been a much bigger scandal. Here's this guy who was a male prostitute, and he's also a Bush-Cheney operative, writing Bush-Cheney propaganda and working especially hard to defeat Tom Daschle in the South Dakota Senate race in 2004. This guy's a hustler. He's a gay hustler. And yet here he is doing the dirty work of a homophobic movement. You know, that kind of thing is really kind of rampant throughout the Bush-Cheney right, and that's because it is not, finally, an ideological movement. It's a pathological movement. It's a sick movement. And it reminds us that paranoia has always threatened Republican freedom. It's always threatened democracy. I mean, wherever something like democracy flowered in our history as a species, paranoia would always be the force that would destroy it, you know, through war. It happened in Greece. It happened in Rome. It happened in the French Revolution.
We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller about Fooled Again, how the right stole the 2004 election, and why they'll steal the next one, too, unless we stop them. Stay tuned for more of our interview with Miller after the break. Back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller about the 2004 election and what it bodes for the election coming up this year. It's part of our special Election 2006 series. Other guests scheduled for the series include Greg Palast talking about his book Armed Madhouse, Peter Galbraith talking about The End of Iraq, Sasha Abramski talks about prisoners losing the vote in his book Cond, Spencer Overton talks about stealing democracy, and Nomi Prince talks about Jacked, how conservatives are picking your pocket. We also have other authors yet to be arranged. You can hear excerpts of the interviews and get other information. Also, sign up for our weekly reminder of upcoming guests by visiting our website at www.writersvoice.net. Now, back to our interview with Mark Crispin Miller. You mentioned fascism, the term fascism, earlier, and here we have paranoia. I think this puts it in kind of a context that, to some degree, fascism is a paranoid movement, not just a political movement. And, well, I wonder if you could, what do you think about that?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think there's a very important component of irrationality in fascism, which is not to say that there, you know, has not been a large component of irrationality in other kinds of tyrannies or totalitarian systems. I mean, you know, we can debate about whether Stalin was a fascist or not. I mean, some have said he was, and I understand that. A purist, a historical purist, would say that he most certainly was not a fascist, that fascism was a distinctive European political movement, you know, of the 20th century.
Well, let's say totalitarianism.
Yeah, I think that when you get right down to it, these threats to democracy, these terribly destructive drives by power to destroy all difference, to undo all divergence from itself, it's almost like an atavistic urge, you know. I do not think that it's ultimately political. It may use political means and political tactics, but its impulse is against politics. You know, I mean, if you want a good example of an, I guess you could call him an artist whose vision is a fascistic vision, it's Mel Gibson. You know, whose films are totalitarian. They are about, like Braveheart, for example, makes politics look sickening, look like so much sort of impotent, irrelevant, you know, yammering. The real heroes are the ones who impose their will. The real heroes are the ones who stand up and stride off into the mountains and are ready for war. That's the vision that he has in all the films he directs, certainly no less the case with The Passion of the Christ. He has a fascist temperament. Well, you know, the Bush-Cheney revolution, or whatever you want to call it, the counter-revolution, you know, it hasn't been put across by any one particular bloc. As I said before, it has its plutocratic impulse, it has its theocratic impulse, it has its neocon membership, it's got a considerable Christian Reconstructionist element. Any revolution that succeeds is going to call on a range of complementary interests that are going to work together. So I don't think it's in any sense uniform, but it is ultimately irrational. Those who support it seem never to use rational arguments to defend its policies. It's all emotional. It's all the kind of mental reflex that you find among paranoids. It's a paranoid movement.
Right, it does. And is that why the press, or is that part of why the press has been so willing to play along with it? Or I wouldn't say willing, but I mean, they've been bullied.
They've been absolutely bullied. You know, for one thing, the press is to a great extent corrupted already by its corporate structure, as is our political system. I mean, in both cases, you have institutions functioning not for the good of their collective, I could call it an audience, although I don't like that word. They're not functioning for their constituents. They're functioning for big donors. So the parties are all about raising money. They don't really care about the voters that much. Likewise, the media cares only about its major shareholders and its advertisers, much more so than it does about its readers and viewers and listeners. So, you know, the press is already corrupt. It's already leaning in the direction of the government, of big power, of whatever helps the parent companies out. What that kind of corruption has not accomplished, I do believe intimidation has. I think the press has been intimidated. I don't think we know even half of what we will one day find out about how this regime has terrified or terrorized the press and the Democratic Party. lot of this stuff people won't talk about.
It's interesting because I asked Helen Thomas, I said, well, you know, so what are the White House press correspondents, do they talk about this? What do they say about this? And she said, you know, I haven't heard anybody say anything about it.
Yeah. Well, it's as if, you know, they get a little finger in the mail every other week, you know, like one of their kids has been kidnapped. It's like that.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So
and
they
often
find
they
a horse's head in their bed, you know.
Right. Okay, so now, Mark Crispin Miller, let's talk about some of the details.
Okay.
You talk about Ohio, and this was one of the things, you know, that I think Manju criticized those who say that Ohio was stolen. And I've heard elsewhere, too, you know, even if Kerry got every single vote of the discarded ballots, that he still would have lost. Talk about the discarded ballots, but also talk about some of the other ways Ohio was lost to Kerry.
Yeah, well, the process of disenfranchisement was a very long and complicated one. And what Bobby Kennedy has done in Rolling Stone is to quantify all those votes that would have been lost because of a combination of tactics. First of all, there were various ways in which people were prevented from registering. You know, Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, who also happened to be co-chair of the Ohio Bush-Cheney Reelection Committee, suddenly ordered that no one could register to vote if they used paper that was less than a certain weight. This was patently indefensible. It was struck down by a court. But the crucial fact is that for 3 weeks, it was enforced. So for 3 weeks, people who were registering had their registration forms rejected. The Republicans engaged in caging. This is sending out thousands and thousands of registered letters to Democratic homes and then disenfranchising all those who didn't reply to the letters. Well, there could be a lot of reasons why people didn't reply to the letters. You know, maybe they were out of town. Maybe they were serving in Iraq. Maybe they didn't want to answer a registered letter from a Republican Party. I mean, there are a lot of reasons. So there were many such moves made prior to Election Day that significantly cut down on the number of people who could register in the first place. Then on Election Day, there were several thousand reports of people who tried to vote for Kerry and had their votes flipped to Bush by the electronic touchscreens themselves. Almost no accounts of Bush voters having had the same experience. And this didn't just happen in Ohio, Francesca. It happened all over the country.
You say that's a statistical anomaly in itself.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if it was a glitch, a harmless and accidental kind of glitch, then it would have happened to Democrats and Republicans equally, but it did not. Far more destructive than the machines clearly programmed to interfere with Democratic votes was the systematic undersupply of working voting machines to Democratic precincts throughout the state and throughout the country, by the way. This didn't only happen in Ohio. But there would be maybe half as many machines as there should have been. We know that in Ohio they deliberately held back thousands of machines that were in working order because they wanted the Democrats to have long lines and eventually have many of them go home without voting, and that's exactly what happened. This did not happen in any Republican precincts. Even the least populous ones were very well supplied, so you could just kind of fly in there, vote, and fly out again. Then there was supposed to be a recount, a court-ordered recount, and the Blackwell machine systematically subverted the recount with the help of a company called Triad, which manufactures the vote tabulators that were used in Ohio. And we have on-the-record testimony of Triad employees actually saying that they went around to different boards of elections in different counties to help them so that they could make sure that it wouldn't have to do a recount by hand. This was a deliberate attempt to subvert the whole process. Now, there are all these different moves that they made. Bobby Kennedy conservatively estimates, and I think the figure is much higher, that 350,000 votes were lost to Kerry because of this, and Bush's victory margin, let's remember, was only 118,000. So there is no way you can argue, if you accept Bobby's figures, as I think that they're too conservative, there's no way you can argue that this did not spell the difference between victory and defeat. Now, let me tell a story about Ohio, just to give you a sense of how ingenious and relentless the Republicans were at delivering the state to Bush. In Warren County, which is a rural county, with a population about half the size of the city of Akron. At the end of the voting, in the evening of Election Day, there was a terrorist alert all of a sudden. A terrorist alert, which caused a lockdown of the premises. The press was ejected from the building before the counting of the vote. And we have a couple of affidavits from people who said they saw votes removed from this Warren County headquarters to an unauthorized location that was under the control of a Bush-Cheney operative. Now, the next day, the FBI said there was no terrorist alert. This is false. And why would there have been a terrorist alert? It's not exactly a target-rich environment, Warren County, Ohio. Then the Cincinnati Inquirer reported that the plan to declare a terrorist alert was in the works for about a week beforehand. I mean, they actually planned this thing ahead of time.
They planned to have a terrorist alert.
Now, when you realize that Warren County was one of the last counties to report its totals, you understand that what they were doing was watching the numbers across the state and trying to figure out how many votes they needed. Now, some may say, oh, no, you can't prove that. All right, fine, you can't prove it. Let's use common sense. If we heard that this had gone on in Belarus or in Ukraine, or if this had gone on under Saddam Hussein in Iraq, would we waste any time arguing over whether it was deliberate or not? Of course we wouldn't. The fact is, because it happened here, we got these people bending over backwards to try to explain this away. And even, you know, progressives, like so-called progressives like Manju and Mark Hertzgard, who attacked the Ohio theory in Mother Jones, claiming that they spoke to some Democrat who assured them that they were there in Warren County and there was nothing suspicious going on. Well, I'm sorry. I don't care what this Democrat told them. I don't know who the Democrat is. I don't know if it's even a Republican in disguise or, you know, a spineless Democrat who works at the pleasure of Ken Blackwell. I don't care who it is. I'm not interested in what a Democrat has to say. I'm interested in the evidence of fraud. The fact is they declared a terrorist alert for no reason. The fact is they had planned it for over a week. The fact is that votes were removed from the headquarters and taken somewhere else, and the fact is that Warren County was one of the last counties to report its numbers. Now, if that's not suspicious, I got a bridge here in New York I can sell you very cheap.
Right. We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller about the 2004 election and how it was stolen. Why do you think that progressives like Manju, I think you mentioned some other folks before that. I spoke to Marcos Melitzis of Daily Kos, who also doesn't think that the Ohio election,
right,
that the election was lost. Why do you think they're in denial?
Because it's too, well, it's a combination of things. I mean, many of them are good people, not all of them. Marcos is a very smart guy. He wants very much to be a mainstream player. He wants Daily Kos to be respected by the establishment. And he's close to the Democratic Party. Combination of that kind of ambition and plain old fear of the true implications of what's happened, that combination is lethal. This is not that hard to understand if you study the history of Germany in the 30s. Why was there so little establishment objection to or protest of Hitler's policies? Why did the Social Democrats just refuse to talk about what he was all about? Why did they keep insisting that, you know, big business would keep Hitler in line, or Hitler only says these things to please his base, but he's a very canny politician? Why, in other words, did the Social Democrats insist on projecting their own rationality onto him? Well, for the same reason that our Democrats persist in arguing that, you know, this is probably incompetence, wasn't fraud. The Democratic National Committee came out with a ridiculous report last summer that, whose whole purpose was to put distance between the committee and John Conyers, documenting all kinds of shenanigans in Ohio and then ostentatiously concluding that there was no fraud committed there. It was all just incompetence and accidents and error. This is because they can't really bring themselves to face the implications of what's happening, because their very lives, you know, their futures, their careers, their lifestyles, it's all based on clinging to the myth, desperately clinging to the myth the status quo is intact. It's really just a matter of tactics and strategy. It's a matter of raising money. It's a matter of fielding the right candidate. It's a matter of coming out with the right message. They must tell themselves this. I have news for them. It is not about that. They could run Jesus Christ for office, and they will lose. Mm-hmm. They could have the most brilliant propaganda campaign in the history of politics, and they will lose. It doesn't even matter how low the approval ratings of the Republicans are. These people are extremely skilled at stealing elections and then making it look like a kind of political ingenuity that they got out the vote, even though you couldn't possibly account for all those voters they got out. They don't exist. But the press will play along with that. They won't go there.
Because they also
don't. They're scared.
Right.
It's too scary.
Right.
And it is scary, and my heart goes out to them. You know? But, I mean, you know, I'm lucky in that I'm an academic. I have tenure. You know, I'm not a reporter who has to live on a reporter's salary. I'm not going to be fired, you know, because management doesn't like what I'm saying. I'm not saying I can't be fired. Anything can happen. But what I'm saying is I have a kind of immunity to the sorts of pressures that most journalists and mainstream Democrats work under. And other critics of the election, like Greg Palast and Bob Fitrakis in Ohio and Steve Freeman, are also immune in these ways. And Bobby Kennedy is immune, you know. He's a Kennedy, and he's respected, he's intelligent, he's got a great track record, and he's rich, right? Mm-hmm. So he's got the integrity to say, look, I studied this, and there's no getting away from it. They stole it. Most people don't have those gifts. They don't have those crutches, those props. So they have to say, you're crazy. This isn't happening.
So is that why Kerry conceded so quickly?
I believe it is. I mean, we may learn someday that they had a gun to his head. But I believe, I talked to him myself just a week before the book came out. I gave him a copy of the book at a fundraiser here in New York on October 28th, 2005. I said, you were robbed. And he said, I know. Said that, and he complained that his fellow Democrats on the Hill won't discuss the issue because they're in denial. He said that to me. He told me that he had had a big argument with Christopher Dodd of Connecticut just the week before, trying to get Dodd to see that the e-voting machines are a problem, and he said Dodd got mad and just said, we looked into this, there's nothing to it. He said, they're in denial. He used the word denial. We talked about, you know, I implored him to come out front on the issue. This was not off the record, by the way. And then I told the story of my conversation with him on Democracy Now! A week later. Democracy Now! Sent out a press release saying, you know, Kerry believes the race was stolen. And within hours, his office had released a statement categorically denying we had the conversation. So here was a guy telling me to my face that his colleagues are in denial. And then when I tell the story of the conversation, he denies it ever happened. Now, my view is that if he really, deep down in his heart, absolutely accepted the truth that he was robbed, as opposed to understanding it intellectually, if he really took it to heart, he would not skip away from it because he's afraid people will scorn him. You know, others have said, you know, he's afraid the press will hammer him. Well, look, if you really believe the house is on fire, are you going to care if people insult you for pointing it out? See, I don't think he really has accepted in his own heart that he was deprived of the presidency. The American people were, you know, deprived of their choice through absolutely anti-democratic means. I don't think he can go there. You know, he still thinks he's going to run. He's out of his mind. He's not got a prayer.
Well, this really begs a whole lot of questions, you know, because I have to say I had a conversation in 2002 when I was in Europe, and this was after the election, the Senate election, where Cleland, you know, had been so savaged,
right.
And that's a whole other case.
Right.
You know, I told people there, I said, these folks are not going to give up power.
Right, exactly.
And so what is one to do? I mean, you make some suggestions in the book. You say that these electronic voting machines have to be done away with.
Right.
First of all, why? And second of all, how's that going to make a difference if they're going to do whatever they need to?
Well, that's just it. The problem, I mean, we definitely and desperately need sweeping election reform. We got to get to paper ballots. And my view is that we should be hand counting them. I mean, you know, there's a lot of argument over whether we should have hand counting or not. I think someday we will have hand counting because no computerized systems are any more trustworthy than the people who program them.
But why would they allow that to happen?
Well, that's just it. Here's what I think we must do. Let me be as concise as I can. I think that we should respond to those who claim we're paranoid by saying, okay, fine, all right, let's grant you, let's just for the sake of argument, grant that you're right and it wasn't stolen. We're still suspicious, but we're going to give you one last chance this year, 2006. We're going to vote, and we're going to turn out in record numbers to vote. I really think if the Democrats have any self-preservation instinct at all, they will urge people to turn out in force on Election Day as a statement on behalf of free elections. We will turn out. We will vote. We're going to monitor this one within an inch of its life. We're going to be watching all the polls, all the polling places. We're going to be studying all the statistics. I don't happen to trust the mainstream exit polling system because that's the outfit that said, oh, the exit polls were wrong. But people will be doing independent exit polls in certain states. We're going to keep an eye on all the statistical evidence. We're going to read all the newspaper polls. We're going to have our eyes wide open. We're going to turn out in force. If there is any indication whatsoever that there's something fishy with the result, when you win again, right, despite your low approval ratings now, you're going to squeak by. You're going to maintain your control of Congress. When that happens, once we have gotten a sense of how and why this is not credible, we are officially refusing to recognize the results of this election. We've gone through this in 2000, 2002, and 2004. It's time to stop arguing about it. You know, if people refuse to see it, that's their problem. But those of us who really believe in American democracy, I don't care whether we're left or right, have got to finally say enough is enough. Even if it's only a local matter, if it's a grassroots thing, we're not recognizing this government. We don't recognize it.
A Ukrainian?
We have to go Ukrainian. It's time. You know, this is the cradle of modern democracy, okay? We have been disgracing its memory by passivity and timidity. It's time for those of us who see the light, and I believe that most Americans actually believe it was stolen. I think a majority of thinking people believe it was stolen. It's time for this majority or plurality to say, no way, we're sitting down. I'm not an organizer, Francesca. I can't say what this means, maybe not paying taxes. I don't know, but the crisis has to come. You know, the crisis was always waiting to happen from the time that they stole the election in 2000. Mm-hmm. We put it off because we didn't want to face it. Business as usual. Okay, the Supreme Court, we like to tell ourselves they fixed it, even though that decision is indefensible and incomprehensible. Well, you know, if we want the freedoms that a democracy is supposed to provide, if we deserve them, we have to defend them. We have a duty to defend them actively and not just go shopping. So my view is we turn out in record numbers for an off-year election. We study it with our eyes wide open, and then when we see that the result is simply insupportable in any rational way, we say, this is it. Goodbye.
Well, Mark Crispin Miller, this is such an important book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, Too, Unless We Stop Them. Thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice. I wish we'd had more time for all the details, but I urge readers to read the book for the details because it is a powerful book and it's a wonderfully written book as well.
Thanks so much.
That was Mark Crispin Miller, and the book was Fooled Again. Since recording that interview, there have been some new developments. On July 13th, the law firm of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court alleging that Diebold and other electronic voting machine companies fraudulently represented to state election boards and the federal government that their products were unhackable. Kennedy claims to have witnesses deep within the corporations who confirm that company officials withheld their knowledge of problems with accuracy, reliability, and security of the machines in order to get government contracts. Since going into service, many of these machines have been linked to allegations of election fraud. And Triad, the company Miller mentioned in his interview with Writer's Voice, was used in the recent Mexican election that's now the focus of accusations of election fraud. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Join us next week for a panel on creative nonfiction. We talk with author Michael Steinberg, founder of the literary journal Fourth Genre Explorations in Nonfiction, and with Deb McCutcheon, author of The Whale Road and creative nonfiction teacher. To learn more about Writer's Voice, visit our website at writersvoice.net. I'm producer and co-host Francesca Rhiannon. Stay tuned for Marla Beebe and Self-Defense.